the principle of design, we're really talking about how we are going to arrange these things. And the first terminology we should learn is composition. Composition is this organization of visual elements, as in painting and photography. So if we can go back and think about the elements of design, if we can go back and think about lines and shapes and colors, the composition is really how are we going to organize these things. And that process of organizing is called design. So design is the result of the process of arranging, selecting, and ordering of elements applicable to the entire range of visual arts. Okay, so for composition, think of what is the overall design? How is it composed? How are lines, shapes, colors, values, etc. being used? Design is the process. How does the artist get to that, overall composition? And so if we take a look at this example by Charles DeMuth, I saw the figure 5 in gold, 1928. It's an example of a oil painting on cardboard. And we can look at some of the compositional elements here. Very large 5 in the center in gold. We also have in the negative space different layers of different values of gray. Some interesting shapes happening with the red, and also different variations of gold as well. Some extra text. Looks like I see a name, Carlo. I see Bill. I see some initials in the bottom as well. We are looking at a painting basically created after a poem. So this number 5, you can say, unifies the whole composition. It's in the center in that it creates a circular motion, in that it allows for our eyes to wander about the overall placement of these objects and these lines. Another term we're going to learn about is unity. So unity is the appearance or condition of oneness. It is a feeling that all the elements in a work belong together. Okay, and so as we look at different compositions, we like to look for things that might group them together. We like to look for similar lines. We like to look for similar shapes. And so let's try to see if we can find some examples of unity in the artworks that we're about to look at. And if you feel that the lecture is going fast, feel free to pause you can pause the lecture anytime. So we're going to look at this work here, John McCracken, Silver, 2006. Basically a polyester, resin, fiberglass, and plywood, a rectangular block leaning against the wall of a gallery space. And I don't know how much more unified you can get beyond that. You're just looking at one object, and that it's by itself, and that is one color. It's basically the opposite of the color behind it. So all we see is unity here. Okay, so on the opposite side of unity, we have variety. Variety is something that provides diversity, in that it counters unity. And if we take a look at this example here, so we talked about unity earlier, we're talking about a variety now. If you were to examine the overall composition, you can say there's a lot happening in this painting. A lot of interesting shapes, a lot of interesting parallel lines, a lot of flatness in terms of how the figures and the shapes are rendered. And you could say there's a little bit of unity among the variety that I just explained. Unity in that we have these shapes that are grouped together, but at the same time, there's so much variety in it that we almost look beyond that unity. So very diverse overall composition. Jacob Lawrence, Going Home, 1946. A painting made in gouache. Okay, so a lot of variety going on in this overall composition. If we look at this diagram here, it shows some of these interesting lines and directionals that are happening within the composition. A lot of repeated triangles, a lot of parallel lines, a lot of parallel shapes, the figures themselves being seen over and over again. There's a repetition in how they are being portrayed. Okay. And so now we're going to talk a little bit about pattern. Pattern is a repetitive ordering of design elements. Randomness and disorder may also be of a pattern. So we like to see a particular sequence of shape or line or color. We like to see these design elements being used over and over again. And when we do notice that, we can right away describe it as a pattern. And sometimes when there's no absolute symbology in terms of design elements, sometimes the pattern can be something like chaos. So we have to be aware of those kinds of characteristics. And so if we take a look at this overall composition, this oil painting, very classically made, very traditional, a lot of interesting patterns. You can see there's a pattern happening on the floor. There's some interesting patterns happening on the wallpaper. You could say there's some interesting patterns happening on the ceiling, especially with those parallel lines guiding us towards the center of the overall work here. There's pattern in the fabric. There's a pattern in also the way the figures are somewhat rendered. I see four figures in the foreground, but at the same time, the painting seems to have almost that same number of figures. So a lot of patterns happening here, especially with the squares and rectangles. Peter de Hooch, Interior of a Dutch House, 1658. A lot of patterns, especially with the squares and rectangles. And if you look at this contemporary work, you can say that the pattern is the idea that there's randomness, and that can also be a type of pattern. There's only a few elements that are somewhat repeated, the wheels on the bottom. There is a repetition of rectangles, and it's something that is somewhat expected when it comes to looking at contemporary works of art. Really, these types of works are there to surprise us and to make us think and wonder what is going on in terms of what the artist was trying to portray. This is a Rauschenberg piece, Gift for Apollo. Even though there's some randomness in terms of the the color, a randomness in terms of the textures within the object. It looks like a door that is being carried around. There's somewhat of a harmony that's being maintained, and I would say that is caused by the rectangles, and that there's somewhat of a symmetry holding it all together. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about balance now. Balance is an achievement of equilibrium in which acting influences are held in check by opposing forces. Okay, so some keywords here is equilibrium. Whenever we think of balance, we think of equal sides in certain ways. So one way to define balance is through a symmetrical balance. Symmetrical balance is when it is a near or exact matching from left to right sides of a three-dimensional form or a two-dimensional composition. So symmetry or symmetrical balance, basically the same exact thing on both sides of an axis. Usually there's an axis of some sort, usually in the middle, in And that's the only way it can really be the exact same thing, both the left and the right side. Think of the human body. The human body, in a way, is meant to be symmetrical. There are so many things in nature that are symmetrical as well. Animals, insects. So a lot of symmetry in nature, in the natural world. And here is an example of symmetry being used in architecture. This is the design for the president's house, elevation 1792, James Hoban or Hoban. So when it comes to architecture, we like to see symmetry. We like to see the same exact thing on both sides. And one of the reasons why, one of the theories behind why we like symmetry so much is that we see it within ourselves. We look in the mirror. We hope to see a symmetrical symmetry in our body, symmetry in our face. And so when it comes to these places where we live and where we work, and we like to see that same idea happening. We like to sympathize with the objects around us. Okay, so a lot of symmetry in the in architecture. And now here is a work of art done in a very symmetrical composition. And some of us might look at it and say, hey, that looks just like a stained glass window, something that you probably have seen inside a church. Okay, and so this is a very symmetrical design here by Damien Hirst, Posterity, The Holy Place, made in 2006. So what is interesting about this work is that it's not of stained glass, it is butterflies and household gloss on canvas. And so Damien Hirst, very successful installation artist, made this work to replicate what we would normally see in a church, but instead he used everyday objects. Okay, something that we mentioned earlier, we like to see symmetry in architecture. You'll see a lot of symmetry when it deals with religious architecture or religious objects in general. We like to see the same exact thing on both sides. We like to see or sense this idea of perfection when it comes to looking at religious objects. Okay? So that was what symmetrical balance was about. Now we're going to talk about asymmetrical balance. Left and right sides are not the same. The elements are balanced according to size and meaning around a center of gravity. So even though there isn't an exact symmetry that we are seeing, usually there's some sort of balance within composition somehow. And it's not really as obvious as symmetrical balance, but in asymmetrical balance, there usually is something still countering the weight that we are looking at, the distribution of elements. And again, I'll show you guys an example of that. So symmetrical is the same exact thing on both sides. Asymmetrical is when it is not. And so let's take a look at this painting here. A classical painting. Maybe some of you recognize the scene that is inspired by the Bible. And if we look at the overall composition of this work here, you can say that it is not exactly the same exact thing on both sides. Instead, it's more of an asymmetrical composition. We have this interesting diagonal happening. In the center, we have a very tall figure on the right, counterbalancing the woman on the left. Okay? And so maybe some of you recognize these figures. If you are wondering, it is a picture of Mary Magdalene. And this painting is called Noli Me Tangere. Noli Me Tangere means don't tread on me. It's the scene in the Bible where Mary Magdalene approaches the tomb in which Christ was was sealed away after his death, and that when she approached the cave or the tomb, that the door was open, and that all she saw was some of the leftover garments he was buried with. And so as she was leaving that tomb site, she saw a gardener, and that the gardener looked just like Jesus, according to the Bible. And I don't know the words. I don't know it word by word, but it is something among those lines where Mary Magdalene approached this man and this gardener, and that he looked like Jesus, and he said to her, "Noli me tangere," don't tread on me. Very, very inspirational, very popular scene in the Bible. And so this is an example of a more asymmetrical design. Okay, and this painting is by the artist Lavinia Fontana, 1581. Okay. That is the example of asymmetrical balance there. And so some characteristics of balance in general: a large form is heavier and more attention getting than a small form. Okay, that kind of makes sense, because whenever there are similar objects around, or shapes, we tend to notice the larger or the heavier shapes than the smaller ones. Two or more small forms can balance one large form. So if there's any way to balance one large form, you put two small forms around it. So that kind of creates a little bit of a counterbalance. A form gathers visual weight as it nears the edge of a picture. So if you can imagine on a 2D space, a painting or a drawing, if there's an object that's close to the edge and it's somewhat isolated, it tends to gather a lot of weight, because it's more of a composition that incorporates this idea of isolation, because it's on its own. It gathers a lot of weight, especially when it's not exactly in the center. If it's drifting off to the side, it tends to gather our attention and lead us there. A small form near an edge can balance a larger form near the center. And so artists are aware of these things. If there is a larger form, say on one side of a painting, they can try to balance it by getting a smaller form, but putting it closer to the edge, opposed to the larger object where it's not exactly in the center, but slightly, you know, towards the left or the right. On the opposite side is a smaller object that's going to balance it. And I'll show you guys an example of that. Complex forms are usually more heavier than a simple form. So if there is a shape and that there is a lot of different textures or different, characteristics about it. Maybe it's sharp. It has sharp edges, or maybe it has more rounded edges, or if these shapes are more complex overall, it is a lot heavier than a shape that is very simple. And that kind of makes sense. It just has a tendency to gather more attention. If you are around a lot of people and someone's wearing a very elaborate, clothing, very colorful and very texturized, you'll notice it more than people that is wearing, very flat colors or very neutral colors. And that comes into this next idea of color balance. So when it comes to visual balance, we think of weight, we think of lines, we think of shape, but there's also a type of balance that deals with color. When it comes to color, for the most part, warm colors seem to be more heavier than the cool colors. So if you can recall the color wheel for a bit, warm colors, the orange, yellows, and red, they gather more attention than the cool colors, which are the blues, purples, and greens. A single small yellow form can balance a large dark blue form. And so you can imagine how much attention a small yellow dot can gather if the whole, say, the whole canvas was painted a dark blue. That small yellow dot will just stand out too much. Okay, so here's another example of the noli me tangere, except that there's more of a color, more of a color balance. And what we mean by that is the figures are usually, when it comes to paintings in general, whenever there are the human form, the human figures, they are usually warm. You know, they're peaches, they're oranges, reds and browns. And so they seem to come forward a little bit more. And in the negative space, in this landscape painting, you can see the very cool greens and the ocean in way in the distance there, the blue in the sky. So we have a little bit of color balance happening here. And this is actually of the same title as earlier, Noli me tangere. Don't tread, please don't tread on me. But this is by a different artist, by Titian. Made in 1514. And so this composition of the biblical scene is portrayed quite differently, but the same story. Okay, some other interesting things about color balance. Warm colors tend to advance forward, while the cool colors tend to recede. Okay, so the figures seem to come forward a little more. They pop out while the cool colors are stuck in the background. The warmer of two temperatures will be visually heavier because it seems closer to the viewer. Okay, so if the intensity of a particular color is stronger, especially when it comes to warm colors, it makes it feel a lot heavier. It gathers more weight, gathers more attention. Intense colors are usually heavier than weak or pale colors, and these can be things like tints or shades. Remember that a tint is basically a color with a little bit of white in it, and that kind of neutralizes the saturation. Or a color can have a little bit of black in it, and that also neutralizes it. It takes away, again, the same, that it takes away some saturation. It doesn't make that color as strong anymore. A single small bright blue form near the center can balance a large pale blue form near an edge. Okay, when it comes to color balance, the intensity or the weight of any color increases as the background color approaches its complementary hue. So when we think about things like complementary colors, if you have a yellow background and there is a purple figure coming forward, you can actually increase the intensity of the color coming forward if you like. You can make the color in the background feel even less intense by adding a shade or adding a tint. So it works particularly well, especially with complementary colors. An example of that is what is being mentioned here. On a green background, a small, simple red form can balance a large, complex blue form. And it says here as well, regardless of the principle, most artists rely on sensitivity to what looks right. So when it comes to the use of balance, and when it comes to artists using these principles of color balance, are they going to follow these rules when it comes to creating the perfect composition? Not really. You know, the artists are going to expand upon what they feel looks better, or what feels better, instead of depending on these rules of balance, because you don't always have to create balance. You don't always have to create the same use the same formula to make strong paintings. It's actually better to to be aware of it and to work around it, to deviate from it. And so let's take a look at this work here. A very asymmetrical piece. Think about color balance. We had the figure coming forward, the figure on a horse, the warmness of the animal there, and the man. Even the figure himself is wearing yellow, so these worms are coming forward, and surrounding him is a lot of this blue and green, and even the sky behind him is a little bit more on the blue side. But if you look at this asymmetrical composition and look at the left side, you'll notice that there's not a lot going on. And because of that, the strong sense of asymmetry comes into our head. But what does the artist do to counterbalance that? He puts a very small sun on the very left-hand side. And that is enough to draw us to that direction and allow for us to, not just look at the objects on the right, but to have something distract us on the left-hand side. And so it's a very interesting composition in that the artist is aware of these rules. He's aware of these rules of composition and balance. This is by Edgar Degas, Jockeys Before the Race, 1878. Okay, and so this diagram here shows us the idea that we have a tendency to look at the object, and then it's going to allow us to say that the eyes of the figure are going to the left, so we have this tendency to look to the left, and we see the other figures there, and then a lot of empty space, but because of that sun, it's drawing our attention to that upper left-hand corner. Okay, so we think about balance not in just 2D works, but also three-dimensional works like this one here, Declaration by Mark de Suvero, 1999 to 2001, 60 feet. And so it looks very much like an oversized compass or this mathematical device. And the artist had to think about things like weight distribution and color distribution on these types of objects as well. Very interesting that many artists, ones that come into mind, Ogdenburg, sorry, and this artist here, de Suvero, like to get these mundane objects, these everyday objects, blow them up in proportion because it allows for us to look at these things in a different light. Imagine something very normally very small, something very tiny that we usually disregard, and that the artist just blows them up, 10,000 times larger than the original. Okay, and so we're going to talk a little bit about these design principles here, emphasis and subordination. Emphasis is what draws attention to an area. If a specific spot or figure is gathering a lot of emphasis, we call that a focal point. So just look at a painting, think of what seems to gather most of our attention. That is probably the focal point. That is probably the point of emphasis. And so on the opposite side of that, we have subordination. Subordination is the use of neutral areas of lesser interest that keep the viewer from being distracted. And so when it comes to creating an overall composition, say that it is a portrait. You want to paint a portrait. You want to make the figure, the person that you are drawing, the person that you are painting, you want to make them the point of focus. You want to put you want that to be what is important from the overall piece. And you do that by putting more contrast, making the details stronger. You make the lines cleaner, more visible. But when it comes to things like the negative space, you don't really want for that to come forward. So what the artists normally do is they think of this idea of subordination. They purposely neutralize the background so that it doesn't gather too much attention. Do they just leave it alone and just leave it plain or blank? No, but they find ways to create less interest, less detail, and that also comes with this idea that things are usually less distinctive when they are further away. So it kind of makes sense to subordinate objects that are in the back. And so there is this idea of directional forces. Directional forces are paths for the eye to follow, provided by actual or implied lines. Usually, these types of directional forces are implied by a form's axis or a connection between similar or adjacent forms or lines. So, whenever we look at a painting and that there seems to be some sort of shape that tends to lead our eye, we call that directional forces. I think right away, I'm thinking of maybe if you guys have seen The Last Supper. I notice a lot of students, they made a lot of work about Christianity, which is really cool. So I'm guessing a lot of you know or probably have heard of or seen The Last Supper. Maybe you have the picture of The Last Supper at home, but you know, just imagine, you know, Jesus in the center of that painting and all of the apostles are facing him. So we have these paths, these eyes that are somewhat guiding us towards the focal points, towards the point of emphasis. Okay, and so actually, wait, hold on, let me pause. I'm gonna go ahead and pause that here. Starting part two of this chapter four lecture, we stopped off talking about directional forces. Something that I haven't mentioned yet is that when it comes to lines, they usually have a particular behavior. If you see lines that are vertical up and down, they say that those types of shapes are usually standing still. And yes, this is all subjective. It all depends on the artist. It all depends on the viewer. And so if you see lines that are usually vertical, usually straight up and down, many people think of those types of directionals as standing still. So it's almost as if they're meant to be held upright. If you see lines that are more horizontal, they are more lines that are being at rest. If you see lines that are in a diagonal, then those are lines that represent motion. Okay, and so again, these are not solidified definitions. It all really depends on the artist, but these types of lines have a tendency to have these behaviors. And so maybe we can agree to them or maybe we can disagree with them, but let's take a look at this example here. Francisco Goya Bullfight, The Agility and Daring of Juanito Apinani, 1815. And so if you were to look at the overall composition, and if we were to think about things like directional forces, you can safely say that the figure draws a lot of our attention. He is being held up by this pole, and something that we might notice is that his body is at a somewhat a diagonal, maybe somewhat close to a horizontal line. You'll notice that his eyes are looking down. His eyes are looking down, almost pointing at the end of that stick, and that is also a spot where the bull seems to be pointing as well. So they're sharing that same focal focal point. They're creating that diagonal that draws us to that very center. You'll notice that the bull itself, the bull, the nose, and that the body is creating somewhat of an angle. Also, it's almost as though a triangle is being created. Something that we can notice, the pole is a vertical line, so we can say that the figure feels like it is standing still at the moment. But because the bull is at a diagonal, it feels like it is in movement. You can also say that the audience in the negative space, they too are, their eyes seem to gaze towards the direction of the bullfighter, and another, adding on to that triangle that is being formed there. So a lot of interesting things going on with lines and diagonals and directionals. And this is a diagram of some of those lines that we can say are implied by the overall composition. A lot of these diagonals pointing to the tip of that stick there. Implied lines coming from the audience also towards that shadow, that direction. So many interesting lines contributing to these ideas of lines at rest, of lines at that are standing still, also lines of movement. Okay, and there is that triangle being created really by the top of the stick, the shadow, and also the hind leg of the bull. Okay. And so you'll see this term being used a lot when it comes to things like composition is contrast. Contrast is this juxtaposition of strongly dissimilar elements. Think of things like dark against light. Think of things like large against small. So there's a contrast happening between these ideas. Contrast provides visual interest and expresses content. It's actually one of the things that we enjoy seeing when it comes to looking at works of art. We like to see contrast. We don't really want to see the same thing over again, even though repetition has a tendency to capture our attention. But the contrast is what makes it a little bit more interesting. And so if we take a look at this work here, Kim McConnell, Woman with Mirror, canvas number 13, 2007. A lot of interesting contrasts happening here. Very abstract, latex acrylic on canvas, 48 inches by 48 inches, so a fairly large square painting, 4 feet tall, 4 feet wide. A lot of interesting contrasts happening within the composition, such as we have these diagonal lines, these triangles, standing parallel to a wavy line. So we have contrast. We have these diamond shapes that are within that space, creating, we see the white diamonds on blue triangles. Right next to it, we have orange stripes. And those are two totally contrasting elements. Blue and orange are complementary colors. You could say that these lines are, we have diagonal lines next to horizontal lines. And so on the left side, we have a very interesting, the yellow there is balancing out the blue on the other side. So many different contrasts happening within one painting. And so rhythm is also important when it comes to these principles of design. Rhythm is any kind of movement or structure of dominant and subordinate sequence. And so when we are thinking about rhythm, we think of things like music. We think of an ongoing sound that in a way grounds us, that we are evaluating, we are determining, is the song, is it a fast song? Is it a slow song? And all of that is really decided by or created by the rhythm. And so we think, okay, it's the same, say, element over and over again, which is a pattern. And so what is the difference? What is the difference between a pattern and rhythm? Well, rhythm is something that deals with movement, and that's the difference. So, you can say that music has a tendency to fluctuate. It feels like there's a little bit of changing, of change. And so that is enough to make it more of a rhythm over it being a pattern, where it's a pattern is more in one area and it doesn't exactly move. And if we look at this here, Donald Judd, Untitled 1990, repetition lends unity, continuity, flow, and emphasis. It's basically the same shape over and over again. And because of the alignment, because of the height of the objects, and that if we can imagine actually being in the physical space of a gallery, and we were to stand next to this piece, it is fairly tall, 14 feet high. So in a way, we have to move around it. We have to look up, in that when we are looking up and then we are looking down, we are feeling the sense of movement. And so we're not exactly looking at the same things over again. Instead, we are looking at it from the more looking at objects more from the bottom, more from this diagonal. And so our vantage point often changes. And so it's more about rhythm opposed to pattern here. Okay, sometimes works or paintings themselves have rhythm in it, not only because of the composition, but also the subject matter. And so we are looking at a composition here that is very influenced by the cubist style. And so we are looking at these variables of darks and lights, these interesting organization of shapes and circles and rectangles. And so we can say that rhythm is embedded in not just the subject matter, because we are looking at a musical instrument, we are looking at abstract depiction of a music player, musician. We see some abstract shapes of instruments, but also the rhythm that's happening with this abstraction, with the darks to lights within each of those individual shapes. Interesting rhythm with even the warm colors towards the lower portion of the overall painting, the light browns and the light oranges, the warm colors in the fingers. We have a lot of interesting rhythmic characteristics going on. Lyubov Popova, The Pianist, 1915. And so this is a good example of how rhythm can be seen from a 2D work of art, a painting. And so if we look at this example here, and right away we think, yeah, it's the same object over and over again. And so we think pattern, but because of this idea that they are moving forward, we have these cranes. It feels like their feet are portraying a sense of them walking forward, that they are marching the same direction. Suddenly it becomes more about rhythm. We like to look for rhythm in many things. Ogata Korin, Cranes, 1700 century. Very large gold leaf painting. So we have rhythm happening with the birds. We have the birds' feet, the birds, the eyes and the beaks and the feathers. We have these interesting rhythmic elements going on throughout the whole piece. A lot of flatness, but at the same time, a lot of movement. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about scale and proportion. Scale is the size relation of one thing to another. You could think of how big will the work be. I feel like scale and size is the same, is used in the same manner when it comes to describing the objects. You can use scale, you can use size, same thing. Proportion, on the other hand, is the size relationships of parts to a whole. So we like to break it down. We like to compare it. The proportion of, say, one part of an object to the whole thing. If we look at this example here, we are looking at how scale plays a really big part in terms of how we feel, how we describe these objects. If you look at the circles in the center of the left, if we look at the circle in the center, oh sorry, center of this left side here, it is a smaller circle being surrounded by what, six larger circles. The circle in the middle feels very small. But if you look at that, if we look at the circle on the right, if we look at the right side of this diagram, it is actually that same size circle, but around it are six smaller circles. And so in a way, it kind of amplifies the size of that object in the center. Even though we're looking at two of the same, if we were to look at these center circles on both sides, they are the exact same, but because of its surroundings, it feels very different. So the objects are visually relative. It changes based on its surroundings. And so if we take a look at this work here, not a painting, it's actually a very large sculpture. It's not a photoshopped photo. It's not a photoshopped picture of a manipulated image. The object here is really that large. So a very large birdie that people use in playing badminton is right in front of this William Rockwell Rock Hill, William Rock Hill Nelson Gallery of Art. And so what the artist did here, Oldenburg, gets these mundane objects, blows them up in scale, you know, 1,000 times its normal size, so that as we approach these objects, that we feel different. We look at these everyday objects in different light. Okay, and so this is actually one of four, Oldenburg and Van Bruggen. Very large size, and because of that, it changes our, say, the interpretation of the object changes because of its scale. And so, something that I like to tell my students when it comes to drawing, if you want to make strong work, you have to try to draw large. Not if you do a lot of strong work in a smaller scale, it won't gather that much attention, and that's just a reality. Okay, so scale plays a large role in the way we look at works of art. This work here, Cruzeiro do Sol, Southern Cross by Cildo Meireles. He has a very small object on his finger, and that is basically his work of art. Or this is one of his pieces. He has actually very many, and he makes a lot of work that is very social. In this case, he purposely creates a very small wooden cube here due to this idea that in the southern hemisphere of the Americas, especially in the Latin and the South America, the Central and South American countries, there's this idea that they contribute so much to the whole world. They contribute a lot of exports, especially things like coffee, but also wood. Wood, a lot of wood is being exported out of the South and Central Americas. And that even though they provide so much of this valuable material to the whole world, they don't actually get recognized for it. Instead, you know,
the Middle and South Americans, they don't really get recognition for their accomplishments. And so that's what the idea is behind this work here. And so the artist finds a way to create a statement just from playing around with scale. Okay, so some other things that deal with scale and proportion when it comes to these principles of design, one of them is format. Format is referring to a size and shape of a two-dimensional picture plane. A format can be seen through these examples. The paper that we use on an everyday basis, especially for school, are 8.5 by 11 sheets, 8.5 by 11 inches, and that is the standard format in terms of what we are using to write with. Another example of format is television screens. The widescreens of today's standards are around this size, 16:9 format. So something that you'll notice, the format of how we view television changes through time. So before, television was more like a square. It was more like a square, then later they decided that they can actually that the human eye can see. They're incorporating more of their peripheral vision, so it's okay to make the screens wider. And so they just kept pushing that idea. And now the screens are very, very wide. It mentions here that the change in proportion can make a difference in the viewer's experience of a subject, and that is very true. When we watch television, if we watch movies, we like to watch it in the large screen. It's just way more exciting. And so, if we take a look at this work here, another work from the Renaissance. And so, this is the very popular scene where Jesus is let down from the cross, and that he is in the lap of Mary. And this is called the Pietà. Okay, very, very fitting for now. I mean, it's Holy Week, right? So, yes, this is a scene of the Pietà done by Michelangelo. And so I actually put a link to this piece here on our Canvas page. So check it out. The closer look you can get a lot of information. Check out all of those other things in the modules. But anyways, something about the Pietà done by Michelangelo is that if you look at Mary, let me go back to the larger work here. If you see how Mary is being portrayed, she is quite tall, and that because Jesus has died and that she is in his lap, and that in a way he feels he is supposed to appear lifeless, but at the same time Michelangelo portrays Mary, she feels very tall in comparison to him. But also not just the length, but the width. If you look at her clothing, and that her arms are outstretched, that her arm is in a blessing gesture. If we incorporate that alongside the fabric surrounding the bodies, it makes her body feel very large. And Michelangelo does this purposely to make her, in a way, the point of emphasis, making Mary very important in this overall scene. Okay, 5 feet by 8 inches, and that, yes, very larger than life. Okay, and so here is another work, another Pietà scene done by a different artist, but done in a very different style. Roentgen Pietà made 1300, so around 100 earlier before Michelangelo's version. But something about this is the exaggeration of the portrayal of Christ, and that his body is a lot thinner, and that there's a little bit more, say, emotions of sadness, of melancholy. And the artist purposely makes him appear that way, and to give more life to Mary. Okay, so a little summary to close up design. Design is not inevitable and may result from multiple changes and decisions. You can say that whenever artists create works, it's not something that they can just do right away. It's actually the result of many decisions. And so if we take a look at this work here by Henri Matisse, State 1 of a Large Reclining Nude, May 3rd, 1935. The figure is quite representational, some hints of I'm not going to say inaccuracies, but abstraction. You could say that the head looks a little bit small compared to the rest of the body. The proportions aren't exactly there. Is that the point of Matisse's work here? Not exactly. And so let's see what he ends up doing with this original design, this original composition. He gets the same work, but then he exaggerates the form. He makes the body larger. If you look behind the figure, you'll notice that he added more lines, and those are actually cutouts. So this is his process in terms of how he decides on his design. He does a little bit of collage, similar to the things that we've been making in class. So the body looks different now. You can see the exaggeration of the elbow. It feels like now it's creating more of a vertical line, opposed to before it was slightly at an angle. You can see that the arm that is on the bottom, that Matisse is trying to bring that elbow back in, or keep that elbow out, but bring the rest of the arm back in. And again, these interesting addition of lines in the back. So here's another version, simplifying some of these shapes, somehow bring the body a little bit more back into proportion, but still somewhat exaggerated, in that the overall background feels a little bit more concise, that the lines are cleaner, that the lines are exaggerated. It doesn't seem like the figure is on the surface it initially was modeled on. And so some interesting things happening with the overall composition here. And here is the original, or the final piece. This is how it ended up looking in the end. Everything is more exaggerated. The color plays a really big part. And that Matisse is a very interesting artist, in that he purposely makes these works that are very expressive. It's not meant to be accurate by any means, but more of a portrayal, his own portrayal of the figure and then the still life combined. But yes, when it comes to design, many things can happen. The artist can change his, overall composition just to exaggerate things. They want to emphasize things. They want to subordinate things to make the overall picture more interesting. But I hope you guys learned something from this chapter. It's very terminology heavy. Ask me if you have any questions. Don't be shy to message me. look forward to more of our lectures. I'll post them as soon as I have them ready. Again, let me know if you guys need any help, and I'll talk to you again soon.